So we are at the Granley Bakken Resort. This is one of the Keystone Symposium meetings. This is our new insights into health span and diseases of aging, from molecular to functional senescence. And we have pulled out three people from the meeting. One of the organizers, Sean Oldham from the Burnham Institute for Medical Research, I suppose now the Sanford Burnham Institute for Medical Research, Paul Shaw from Washington University, St. Louis, and Mark Tater from Brown. Let me just remind everybody what your three talks were about, and then we'll see how it all links together. I'm just interested in this. Sean, you talked about the role of nutrient-sensing TOR pathway in obesity and aging. TOR is target of rapamycin, so we're talking about, we'll get into that later. Paul, yours was a much simpler one, sleep aging.
Sure.
That was it. And I'm just looking to see what Mark's was.
Mark.
Drosophila as a model for analysis of innate immune aging. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys have in common? What's?
We all work on flies.
You all work on flies?
Yeah. That's not completely a joke about it.
One of the things that occurs to me is that I've been to meetings on sleep, I've been to meetings on stem cells, been to meetings on aging. I now see people from different communities coming together. Paul, you usually work on sleep. Your department, Sean, at Burnham is neuroscience, stem cells, aging, right? So there's stem cells involved in there as well?
Yeah, but I'm also in the cancer center as well.
Right, okay. And you work on fruit fly?
Yes, and I'm in the ecology department.
Are you going to be working together on a project? Do you have it? Isn't that part of what's going on here?
Yep. So I'll explain it, right?
Yes. Why don't you explain it?
It should be Rolf Bodmer. He's the missing part of this, who is working on cardiac aging. And it really started between Rolf and I a number of years back, where he was working on a model of how fly hearts change with age. And I was working on insulin signaling. And we just sat there and asked together, does these genetic manipulations that slow aging in flies also slow functional aspects of aging? Because it's hard to relate lifespan of a fly to lifespan of humans, but humans all experience, you know, cardiac aging as we get older. And so that's what started this idea of looking at the functional aspects of aging. And then what's happened over the years is we decided we wanted to build that all up as a new approach to study, a new model to study, you know, physiological, medically, clinically relevant aspects of aging in a model system where we could do really powerful genetics. Mm-hmm. And that's what brought us all together was I was beginning to work on the time also immunity in flies, which people don't think they have an immune system, but they do. And it goes downhill as they get older. And then...
How long do flies live?
Well, 30, 40 days. Yeah. And then we brought in Paul because he wrote this amazing paper that on sleep, and there was this cool data buried in it on aging in sleep. And we said, well, that's something that goes bad when you get older if you haven't noticed yet. Mm-hmm. And then, and Sean being...
Bringing up the rear.
Yeah, Sean was at the Burnham at the time, and another aspect of aging is stem cells in the intestine, and that's what he's working on. So we banded together to try to advance this new approach.
I mentioned to you earlier that one of the great founders of modern experimental science, Francis Bacon, who lived in the 16th century and the early 17th century, wrote extensively about aging. He also wrote about sleep, incidentally, and raised a whole bunch of issues about it and so on. And it's a little bit astounding in one sense to think that 350 years on from the foundation of the Royal Society, we still don't know what sleep is for. We still don't know exactly why we age. We still don't know if we have a use-by date, whether we can extend lifespan and so on. And I suppose that one of the answers to this, but I'll ask you anyway, is that it's only recently that we've had the technology, the tools, to allow for the kind of deep analysis that really can provide answers to those kind of questions. Mm-hmm. So give me some sort of context in terms of how the field has been changing over recent years. I mean, you were mentioning when you started as a student.
People have been interested in senescence and aging for a long time, but it has been very much descriptive science,
right.
Gerontology. And you could describe things that happened to animals as they get older, and the only way you can manipulate that to begin to understand the mechanism was diet restriction, which has been known for 60, 70 years. But it didn't get us to the genetics, which brings us to mechanisms and how things work. And the breakthrough really came in the early 90s in people working in the nematode, C. elegans, this teeny little nematode, when they noticed that these mutations that caused them to go to this quiescent, quiet state called dour, also slowed the aging when they were older, not in the dour, but in a normal lifespan. And then two groups, Cynthia Kenyon and Gary Ruvkin, cloned the gene that caused this dourness, and it turned out to be the insulin receptor. Right. And that was the birth of all, this is only 1993, was that about right? So that was like an explosion going off, because suddenly we had all these molecular genetic tools to actually dissect the process of aging. So it's a very young field at the molecular mechanistic level.
Would it be accurate to say that an even more distinct turning point would be 1953 with the publication of the paper, Crick and Watson's paper about DNA? You're then getting into the genetic code, the whole field of genomics starts, Sidney Brenner comes up with C. elegans as a model organism. That all leads to this as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So how does your part come into this? I mean, at what point is there a real shift in understanding of sleep and using these model organisms?
Well, so in my interest in using the flies is inspired by the success of the genetic tools that were developed in the 90s. And it became obvious to even somebody who didn't know anything about genetics that it was a very powerful way to go. And so, you know, the sleep as aging is very, very complicated, and we've spent a lot of time descriptively trying to figure out what's going wrong, what's going right, and it hasn't gotten us to the level we want to be at. The nice thing about these genetic tools oftentimes is that you can do a lot of discovery, you can find new things, and it's inescapable. So a lot of the same problems that I think the field of aging had in terms of making progress and grabbing a foothold onto some kind of mechanism are the same kind of problems we face in the field of sleep research.
Sean, from your end?
I think it's clear that, you know, it is kind of the advance of the genetics, and it's really now that we have all the genes published in the genome, we can really go in and kind of ask, you know, which ones are involved. But one aspect I think, you know, you alluded to why is it taken so long is science is an inherently slow process. You know, Sean Morrison talked about how long it takes to set up a mouse experiment. So some experiments literally can take 5 years to do. And so, you know, I think that's part of the inherent slowness to the process. But, you know, at the same time, we now have so much information available that I think we can really start to do, you know, more informed and intelligently designed. Oh, I didn't say that. you know, experiments that have, you know, we have more ways to think about the experiment. So I think it's going to certainly get faster. But some of these are very deep and profound questions that, you know, are not simple answers. I mean, some experiments are easy and some experiments are hard, and you just kind of have to roll with it in a certain degree. And, you know, the one thing, too, that in terms of this project is, you know, we've all been working on the insulin TOR pathway to various degrees, and that, you know, that seems like may be a common link or thread in terms of coordinating the aging of different organs and then how that may impact, you know, and longevity, which was really kind of the motivation for putting this symposium together in the first place.
Do you want to just explain what TOR, target of rapamycin, means? I mean, this strange nomenclature that ends up being used, but what's the basic story here?
So there's a long story to TOR. It was originally came out of people who went to Easter Island and took soil samples from there, and then found this compound called rapamycin, or they named it rapamycin due to the fact that the original name of Easter Island is Rapa Nui, and it was originally used for immunosuppression. And actually, it was originally used as an antifungal, and then Mike Hall, who was actually interested in understanding how other immunosuppressants worked, used the fact that rapamycin was a cytostatic agent in yeast and found a gene that basically would prevent the actions of rapamycin, and he cloned that gene and named it target of rapamycin. And so it's kind of gone through this long and meandering history, and the more people, you know, study TOR, the more they realize it was a very central component of this nutrient sensing pathway. that coordinates a lot of aspects of homeostasis, including growth, which was originally one of the things that it was noted for, and it's actually gone on to be used as an anti-cancer agent. And now it's really becoming clear that TOR is also very central in terms of regulating metabolism and aging, and that's kind of where I think the TOR field is at right now.
Yeah, there's this preview in Cell by Brian Kennedy up at Washington, who mentions that several studies indicate that reduced TOR signaling underlies lifespan extension by dietary restriction. So we're talking about bringing these things together. In terms of dietary restriction, calorie restriction, CR as it's often called, or DR for dietary restriction, is that now generally regarded as being an effective way of extending health span and lifespan?
Yes, if you're a rodent, a mouse, or a worm.
All right. And the experiment, the trouble here being what? That these are slightly artificial conditions that they're raised in, that the chow is?
No, it's hard to get data on humans in non-human primate models. So people are struggling to know, you know, you say, is it accepted? I say, yes, in these models, it's fantastic. And so it's a very good tool then to try to understand underlying mechanisms that slow down or speed up aging. But it's hard to know if it's going to be effective as a treatment in us.
Yeah, one of the troubles about this, of course, is that because everybody sleeps and everybody lives and everybody ages, everybody thinks that they're sort of a natural expert on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are organizations out there and all sorts of people who immediately take whatever information comes out of your community and start applying it, mm-hmm. because they think, what have I got to lose? So there are masses of people out there practicing calorie restriction. There are organizations doing that.
Yes.
And you would say to them,
they're missing out on some good meals.
what is the serious evidence here in terms of calorie restriction in humans?
Is there?
Nope. We're doubtful about this.
Well, you know, there actually are some studies, and they're short-term studies, and I'm trying to remember this. What's the name of the institute in this? The Pennington study, or yeah. Where there are some serious controlled studies where you put people on, you have control groups, experimental groups, we know exactly how much they're eating, and they're looking at the physiological parameters that, you know, change in humans, let's say in a 2 or 3 year period under dietary restriction, and then trying to compare those to the kinds of adaptations that have been observed in mice, where we know that those correlate well with longevity extension and reduction in disease. And those look very promising. So I would say that's the best evidence that's out there. The issue they suffer with is it takes 2 or 3 years of a dietary restriction regime to change your metabolism and your physiology to sort of the next, to shift the homeostasis to the new level. Mm-hmm. So even in mice, when they do this, it takes months before they go, they have to lose body weight and they change their metabolic rate and they undergo these adaptations. And in the scale of humans, that takes years. And so the studies that have been done so far only go to that very edge. And we don't actually know what the long-term consequence is going to be.
Okay, are we on safer ground if we, let's look at this one then. Life, this is from Cell again, Cell Metabolism. Life is short if sweet. Insulin is essential for glucose homeostasis, but reducing its activity delays the aging process in model organisms.
Mm-hmm.
So are we right to think that cutting down on sweet foods is a good thing to do?
That's a too open-ended question.
Yeah.
Rephrase it as you wish. Look, here's the New England Journal of Medicine. Ounces of prevention. The public case, public policy case for taxes on sugared beverages.
But this is not about aging. These are really important, I would say, facts about it, but they're in the context of public health. It's just too much high-calorie, high-glycemic food is bad for us. And causes a lot of morbidity and comorbidity.
Right.
And cutting down on that is going to make us healthier overall. I don't think it's necessarily going to change the aging process, but it's definitely going to make us healthier and more successful as we age. But it's, and I think this goes back to, we're eating food that we did not evolve to have. So we can consume it in the short run, and it will, you know, we'll put on weight, and we can survive in the winter if we have to. But this constant consumption of high caloric food like this is causing a lot of metabolic problems. But it's not aging. People are just working hard and trying to connect this to aging because they're trying to understand the mechanisms of caloric restriction or dietary restriction. But I think they're kind of crossing their wires when they bring up these as models for the mechanism. We don't really know what the mechanism is. Do you agree with that, Sean? You work closer to this than I do.
No, I totally agree. I think it's, you know, it's clearly the, you know, the obesity epidemic is probably predisposing to disease and not necessarily, you know, affecting the lifespan. We don't know that yet, though.
Title of this meeting, though, was New Insights into Health Span and Diseases of Aging.
Right.
So diseases of aging suggests that there are, again, you know, here's a magazine article. So this is these are the facts. These are what people see out there. Can we cure aging? That presupposes that aging is a disease, right? Do you think it's a disease?
Yes. But it's an underlying, it's a very deep disease that does not have one pathology. But one important pathology it does have that's very common is cancer. The biggest risk factor for cancer is how old you are. So the process of aging is increasing your risk of cancer. That's an underlying degenerative process that's leading to that particular pathology. And it's not, there's environmental risk factors, but the biggest factor for it is actually how old you are. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think we mean by health span and diseases of aging. I mean, the one that I'm trying to build a model of to work with Drosophila is immune senescence. So you have an adaptive immune system and you have an innate immune system. And both of those immune systems go down the tubes as you get older. It's not because of what we eat that might modify the rate it changes, but it's a function of how old we are because there's something that's fundamental within all our cells that's changing as we get older that leads to high inflammation, risk of infection, autoimmune disease, poor response to infection, all these sorts of problems that we have that are correlated and caused by this underlying process of aging. Mm-hmm. And that's the goal of us trying to work together with Drosophila as a model for this, is to bring these really powerful genetic tools that you can only do in a model system like flies or C. elegans, or now it's more and more in mice, where you can do genetic manipulations that you get to look at the underlying cause of the disease phenotypes. And that's where the advances are coming in, is by actually going down to the genetic level and trying to pick apart what the causes of age-dependent diseases are.
All right, so if aging is the issue, given what you were saying there, so what are the prospects then for life extension? So the Grim Reaper is kept at bay a little longer.
I mean, just within the last century, I mean, the number of people living longer is greatly increased. So, you know, I think on that level, you know, kind of optimizing the environment and optimizing, you know, or understanding the genetic mechanisms that predispose you to aging. I mean, if we can understand those, then, I mean, certainly people will.
That's
live
not getting
longer.
What Mark's talking about, though, is it? I mean, you can obviously improve the water, have people eat better foods and so on, but there's still this fundamental underlying.
But I think what Sean's meaning, if I can try to guess
yes,
what meaning by
please.
This, is what we get from studying the genetic mechanisms, I don't think there's any prospect of diddling around necessarily with, you know, the genes that we have, but it leads us to the mechanism that will then inform us on what kind of environmental interventions we can take, right. Be they drugs, diet, plasma transplants. You know, as we were hearing this morning, you know, there's something about, there's some probably hormonal factors that are circulating in the blood of a young individual that if you expose an old individual to that, it sort of rescues or resets their stem cells to a younger state. So if we know what the mechanisms are that we can discover through genetics, then we can design hormonal manipulations or diet manipulations that actually can optimize, you know, our systems as we get older to reduce the rate of aging or the risk that they cause, you know, they lead to causes certain diseases.
Now, what is the story? What are the prospects in terms of stem cells, in terms of regeneration?
Clearly, they're, you know, in terms of using, you know, embryonic stem cells to, you know, recreate cells or tissues that get lost, as a, you know, that's going to be a tremendous step forward, obviously, in terms of, you know, if you lose something, you can replace it, right? It's kind of a spare part, if you will. I think the way that we're thinking about, and clearly others are thinking about it too, is more of kind of an endogenous regeneration, like how to prevent stem cells from turning off or becoming too active during aging. And, you know, at this point, we don't know whether what impact that will have on the overall lifespan or aging, but it seems like a logical approach to at least look at and see what kind of contribution they'll make. You know, I mean, clearly some stem cells are probably more important than other stem cells in terms of, you know, regulating organ aging and lifespan, but we really don't know that right now. And once again, you know, does the signals that control stem cell aging, are those involved in, you know, the aging of other organisms? Is it really a unique thing, or is it, you know, or is there a more common, you know, mediators to it?
Hormonal. Yeah, there's a narrow line here, though, isn't there? Because there's a tendency to want to encourage a general audience out there about the hopeful prospects and so on. You know, the science needs funding and so on and so forth. But then you actually drill down and sit with a group of people who are actually at the bench, they will draw back somewhat and say, well, you know, it's not quite there yet. We have to be a little bit careful about how much we're promising and so on. So some of these articles are a little bit...
But that's the hope, right? I mean, these smart people who are doing these experiments they see the potential future, and that's what's driving them forward, and that's allowing them to take all the setbacks and all the confusion and all the complexity and continue to work day in and day out they're trying to get somewhere in particular. So I don't think that we should be upset when somebody that's working on a very complex problem sees a target that has huge ramifications for public health and safety. This is where I'm trying to head to.
Right.
Now they may get there sooner or later than they might wish, but we shouldn't judge them harshly for having that vision. In fact, we should embrace that and encourage them to. And the more they talk about it, the more people start to realize that there are visions out there. And there may be even an alternative vision that someone now might be able to come up with because of this kind of visionary statement.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the public also is really quite, you know, intelligent and well-informed of these issues. I think they have a very, you know, mature understanding of what the science process is these days and what it really can and can't do. And so even though there's sometimes big media splash hype stories, you know, I think the public's pretty smart in terms of judging that stuff and what it can, provide for them. I mean, even scientists don't know the timeline. I mean, that's just really the one thing that's hard to predict.
What about this connection between science and social policy, though? I mean, given what you know about the effects of a diet that's high in calories, high in sugar, and so on and so forth, I mean, do you think it is reasonable to say that in the same way as that there's a warning on cigarette packages, that perhaps there should be a tax on sweet foods?
Well, maybe not a tax, but there's I have some colleagues that work on the obesity problem in their public health, and they think that what we need to do is we have to have a campaign that's government sponsored because of the magnitude of it, that's as serious as when the government made the anti-smoking campaign. Mm-hmm. Smoking is you know it's bad for you. It's a very hard habit to change. It's incredibly expensive socially as well as to individuals. And it took a massive effort and over 20, 30 years of public health and policy and education, and it brought the smoking rates down tremendously in this country. And they argue that we have to do the same sorts of things about our eating habits and the kinds of food that we have and how we eat and how we don't exercise, because what's happening, you know, now is the avalanche of obesity is increasing, and is going to be as bad or worse than cancer caused by cigarettes. But it's a behavioral problem, and it has to be attacked at a public health policy level. We know biologically, we know what to do here, you know, and a lot of people are working on a pill to solve the problem, you know, a pharmaceutical, but really the problem is behavioral. And I would endorse that we should have a really strong emphasis to change that at a cultural level.
So, in fact, are you basically saying that a lot of the emphasis on Big Pharma is ill-placed at this point? That a lot of it is more behavioral?
No, I mean,
it's, no, they're making drugs to change behavior.
it's if you could make a drug that would let people continue with this pleasurable behavior of eating and sedentariness and the lifestyle that we have that people seem to enjoy, but not have the consequences, that would make a lot of money.
Would it make a lot of sense?
Depends if you're a shareholder or not. Have
your cake and eat it. So, I mean, given the work that you do, what would your advice be to? I mean, what do you do yourselves? I mean, what would you say to somebody? Keep your telomeres long and skip dessert, or what? I mean,
use it or lose it.
Everything in moderation, including moderation.
Gerontologists often, you know, geriatricians, they say use it or lose it. You know, be moderate, don't go crazy. You don't have to diet restrict yourself, but.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that Mark's making with DR. I mean, clearly, you know, life is very dynamic, and I think there needs to be times when you need more growth and, you know, times when you may need less. And, you know, you can't just make that a flat line. I mean, there's probably, you know, some negative benefits there. And that, you know, at least DRs, you know, you have a slower reproduction. So when you, you know, have a baby, you obviously want to, you have to have it grow. You're not going to DR while you're pregnant. You're not going to DR your children. I mean, you know, clearly it's a much more complicated process in terms of the time and probably some of the dynamic ranges that at least, I mean, TOR signaling probably has to be upregulated at times and probably downregulated. And, you know, we don't know this now. Yeah, so it's...
Well, you know, one of the things about DR with humans, and I've probably told you guys about this idea before, I'm not sure it would work. Because in all the animals that I know of that it does work on, it induces a torpor-like state, like in rodents. They lower their core temperature several degrees every day, and then they raise it again. And this is what happens in a diapause state, or for them, you know, hibernation. They lower their core temperature. Humans can't do that. We have our physiological boundaries are much tighter than rodents and flies, which can overwinter, you know, in a torpor state and things like that. And I wonder sometimes, is this because of the cognitive state that we have, that our brains can't tolerate the drop in glucose and, you know, the drop in temperature and still maintain the intellect and the cognition that makes us uniquely human? So that if we did diet restrict ourselves, you know, our bodies wouldn't actually permit us to do it. And we wouldn't get the benefit from it because we have buffering to keep us from going into that range that a lot of other organisms, that's part of their natural history, so they can do it.
So give me some sense for people as well. You come. This is a Keystone Symposium meeting. Mm-hmm. Keystone Symposium has been going for quite some time now, about 40 years, I think, this couple of years' time. Lots and lots of meetings. You guys go to lots and lots of meetings. How does this one rate? Are you having...
I'm not
are you learning?
Answer
you're
that.
An organizer.
it's a great
a
meeting.
Conflict of interest.
It's a great meeting. I'm coming from the field of sleep primarily, so to come here and learn more about various aspects of aging is hugely beneficial.
So
it's fabulous.
Yeah, your take.
Well, there's two things. Well, like I was saying before, how the field's changed so much. 20 years ago, this meeting would be very descriptive, and now it. The talks are amazing. They're so mechanistic, and the depth of the field is incredible. I think the progress has been incredible for the past 15, 20 years. But the other great thing is the diversity of topics, from, you know, stem cells to endocrinology to, you know, synthetic biology, computational theory, and this is like coming to, if you're a biology geek, this is like coming to an amazing learning experience where mm-hmm. half the talks you might not know what they're talking about, but you learn so much because it's not super specialized in the techniques and the questions they're asking. I've never been to a specialized meeting. You know, I always come to these, but you know, I think this is fantastic.
During his inaugural, President Obama said that one of the things that his administration would do would be to restore science to its rightful place. Didn't say where that was, what the coordinates were, but do you have some sense of what, do you have an opinion about what the rightful place of science is in society?
Of course.
Well, President Obama's not going to say it.
Of course what?
Of course we have opinions.
And what would your opinion be?
It's the fundamental structure of Western society is based on science and technology and engineering. That's what's made our culture what it is now. And it's probably the most important development in the modern times. And I think that it needs to, we're suffering now, but everything is in this economy. But our whole education system and the research structure in the United States is the best there is in the world. And you know, it will go through rough times, but continue to keep going, and it's going to provide a lot of insights and nurturing for the whole the United States. I think it's really key to us.
So, what do you think is the next? What are you looking forward to in your respective disciplines now, or your collaboration? What's the trajectory that you see ahead? What are you hoping to find in the near future?
Oh, I can't answer that question.
Well, you must have some proposals ready.
I'm not going to answer that question.
You don't want to give out your hypotheses at this point?
No.
Well, I'm doing all the talking, but I think the thing that
he must have some data that he doesn't want anybody to hear.
I think the thing about Drosophila, and again with C. elegans, you can see these in the talks, and this is, I think, what would drive all of us, is that we can use the mutational analysis, forward genetics, as a tool of discovery. When we build the right models for a particular functional aspect of aging, be it, you know, why sleep declines or immunity or stem cell function or cardiac function, if you ask why does that happen in a human, we don't know. We build the model in the flies, and what we want to do is just unleash, you know, this open-ended discovery where we can go basically knock out every gene in the animal one at a time, which is standard practice in our field, and see how that affects the functional aging processes that we're all interested in. So I think what we're after is we don't have a preconceived idea because it's an open-ended discovery. Let's find the genes that regulate these aging pathologies. Let's work together to do that. And then we can ask questions, are they the same genes that regulate immune aging and sleep and stem cells? Or are they different genes? And then try to figure out what the pathways are that control this process. So use this teeny little genetic model as an open-ended exploratory tool. It's like setting out on a boat into the ocean. You don't know where you're going, but we know we're going to get there.
Yeah, I don't think it's too open-ended at all. I mean, with great respect. I mean, if I asked you, what would you like to get out of this? What do you hope your career will produce? I mean, would your answer be that you'd hope to understand the function of sleep in your organism?
Definitely, that's the ultimate goal, is the function of sleep. Why do we sleep? And I hope that by understanding how sleep changes with aging, I'll get there.
Yeah. So, in a parallel sense, Sean, that was what I was getting at. Is there some goal that you have in mind? Let's put it that way.
I can't answer that question.
He has a hidden agenda, but we don't know. I don't know what it is.
This part gets censored out, right?
All right, he's going to tag along with you too and see whatever comes out of it. All right, so next meeting, or we'll get together and find out how this enterprise, this adventure of yours went. And
yep. We'll come visit you in San Diego sometime when it's nice and sunny.
Okay, all right, great. Mark Tater, Paul Shaw, Sean Oldham, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.